Why today we have three names in that field, very well-known names. We missed the third person here, well-known, Vincent Brown, Frank Connolly, and Harry Brown. So in the next few minutes, we have keynote speech from three of them on the subject, do the media influence our political views? We know that local and European elections are ahead of us. So we're going to ask them to give a speech that shouldn't be longer than 15 minutes, but could be shorter, because we have after that question and answers, and I hope you are eager to ask them a few questions. So we will start with Harry Brown. He's a journalist and lecturer in the School of Media at DIT, and he held Metro Iran as well, I believe, Harry, is that true?
And, in the past, yes.
And well known for his investigative journalism, and I think he was doing some work on how the journalists should be kind of wary of being part of charity funding and something like that. So he is questioned on questionable things. Well, Harry, you know what?
Thanks very much, Elena, and thank you to the organizers of this event for asking me along. I don't write about any radio anymore. It's not my weekly beat as it was for many years, but I still love it, and I love community radio and the work that you people are doing here, and it's a real honor to share a room with you and hopefully to hear what you have to say over the next hour or so. I think they put me on first because I'm the lecturer, and I'm supposed to kind of set the academic tone for the occasion and try to. Presumably, I'm going to have three parts, and I'm going to focus on the question. And all. I don't know. We'll see how I do. But the question, I guess, is really a question for this session. This question about do the media affect the way we think politically, or something along those lines, is a question about effects. It's a question about what are the consequences of what media do. So we can. We can talk about what media produce, but this question asks us to try to think further than that and to think about what the consequences of how media cover various issues. And to be honest, the scholarship in this area isn't something that gives us very clear answers about those effects. You know, obviously it's the sort of thing that academics and researchers do try to pin down, but insofar as they've been able to pin it down, they haven't been able to pin it down very far. And probably the consensus view, if you were to look in the political communications field and say, you know, what are the effects, what can we say about the effects of political coverage on political thinking, is that we don't have really clear evidence that media persuade people what to think about politics. In other words, people come to political coverage with their own views, and those views tend to be confirmed no matter what the nature of the coverage is. But we do know that the media can tell us what to think about. So it's not so much what we think, but it's what we think about. What are the issues that are on the table? What are the debates that are legitimate? What are the constraints of that discussion? The media can tell us, the media can constrain what it is that is actually available for us to think about. And I wanted to concentrate, for the purposes of a relatively short presentation today, on one of the means by which powerful players, corporations, governments, PR companies, etc., can have the effect of constraining the range of debate on important issues. Some of you may be familiar with the Chomsky and Herman propaganda model and the filters by which Noam Chomsky and Ed Herman suggest that media coverage is constrained. And one of them is called FLAC. And FLAC is actually probably the one that is least often talked about. But I think, and I've been thinking about it a lot lately, I think FLAC is really, really important in understanding how it is that media come to constrain what it is that we consider to be legitimate to think about, what is the range of discussion that we're able to have about topics. FLAC is essentially the capacity of organizations and individuals outside the media to bring pressure to bear on what it is that media can do, to make legal threats, solicitors' letters, to make formal complaints or informal complaints, to have phone calls coming in and letters coming in. FLAC is something that can be mobilized professionally, or it can be mobilized by activists in an amateur way. But FLAC is something that has a surprisingly large effect on the capacity of media organizations to pursue certain kinds of stories. And one of the interesting things, it seems to me, about the way FLAC works is that it's very rare that you get a corporation bringing FLAC into a media organization saying, you have to tell our side of the story and only our side of the story. That's not usually the way FLAC works. The way FLAC often works is in the name of balance. Balance, this virtue of the media sphere, this idea that there are at least two sides to every story and we should give them at some sort of equal coverage. Balance is one of the kind of the high virtues of professionalism in journalism. And it seems to me that the power of that word and the power of that alleged virtue in journalism is actually deployed by powerful FLAC creators in order to make it harder to tell stories, in order to restrict the capacity to tell stories, and in order to close off lines of debate and argument. Now, the idea of balance is deployed in very unequal ways. So, for instance, if you listen to Morning Ireland, there are, in the first hour of that program, there are two slots for business news. There's no slot over the whole of Morning Ireland for labor news. There's no point at which a worker's perspective on the operation of capitalism is built into the structure of the program. Instead, 10 minutes out of every program is devoted to a capitalist perspective on the operation of capitalism and cheerleading effectively for that. And no regulator will come along and say, oh, wait a minute, Morning Ireland is imbalanced because it has business news but no labor news. So, of course, the operation of balance is within a framework of regulation and of ideology that sees some issues as needing balance and others as common sense that don't require that kind of balance. I came across a funny example of the way the need for balance can suddenly erupt and cause difficulties when I was trying to promote a book I published last year. It was a critical book about Bono, and one of the main RTE current affairs programs said that they would have me on to talk about the book, but only in the context of a debate where I was debating with somebody else who would be against the book, and they're sort of pro Bono, as it were. So I had no problem with that. I was ready to have a debate, but it did strike me as kind of funny that after 35 years of completely obsequious RTE coverage of U2 and of Bono, suddenly they discovered the need to have balance in relation to his career and his work and particularly his philanthropic work, which was what I was concentrating on. And then, of course, the punchline was they couldn't find anyone to defend Bono in a debate. So I was unable to go on that particular program. I would have said, do the empty chair routine. We tried to get somebody to defend Bono, but nobody would come on and do it. But no, but they decided because they couldn't get someone to sit across the table from me that there'd be no discussion at all about it. But there are two much more important stories that I want to kind of just talk about briefly here in terms of this the way that balance is deployed, the way FLAC is deployed to push for balance, and that can end up having a destructive effect on our understanding of stories. And the first one is in relation to the Corrib gas project in County Mayo. And I'm particularly glad to be able to talk about that here because Frank Connolly, one of my colleagues on the panel today, one of the last acts of the very excellent Center for Public Inquiry that Frank headed up now almost 10 years ago, was to create a document, an investigation and a piece of research about that project, which I think still stands as one of the single best things that you could possibly read in order to understand it. Obviously, it's been overtaken by events to some extent, but you won't see, I don't think, a better introduction to Corrib than the Center for Public Inquiry document. But I was down in Mayo a few weeks ago at an event organized by AFRI, which was an attempt to look at the media coverage of that story, and including a lot of testimonies from local people about how their stories and lives had been distorted by media. But the thing that struck me the most and really came home to me was the couple of journalists who talked about how Shell brought flak to bear every single time they tried to cover the story. So Betty Purcell was there from RT. There was a local radio journalist as well, and then other journalists in the audience who actually talked about this as well. And Shell would bring this flak to bear, as I said earlier, not to say our side of the story is the only legitimate side of the story. Not at all. Shell had a very professional, smart PR operation with a very experienced journalist in charge. And he would say, balance. You need balance. Don't you understand? You know, there's two sides to this. You're being exploited by the one side if you're only telling their story. So we need balance. And so every time a journalist would work on the story, not only would they get the call from Shell, but their editor would get the call from Shell. Their producer would get the call from Shell. The RTE journalist, Betty Purcell, talked about how the Shell PR was able to get into RTE and sit in the canteen in RTE making phone calls to RTE staff about the need for balance in relation to this story. So what's the effect of that? If you're a journalist, it's really pretty straightforward. I am not going near that stupid story. I'm going to have to deal with the lawyers. I'm going to have to talk to my editor. I'm going to have to print the PR from the company. And even if I do all that, I'm probably going to have them down on my neck the next time. That's a story to tell in the minimum possible fashion, if at all. I think I'm going to put that aside. You know, and it's really been only a few very brave journalists who have kind of carried on and tried to and really investigated that story and told it in the to the extent that it needs to be told. And it seems to me that the professional flack has been a really important constraint on how that story is told. The capacity of Shell to say balance, not to say just tell our side, but to say balance, and of course in saying that to create a lot of distortions around the reality of the story and around the reality of the protest down there. And the other issue, I guess, that I'm also sort of close to and involved in that I want to bring up that I think has a similar kind of effect and consequence is the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I feel close to this one because I was on a trip to Gaza last year and eventually became part of an organization called Gaza Action Ireland. And now, Israel's capacity to generate flak is very well known. Calls from the embassy and formal complaints, but a great international network of kind of online, trolls, to use the sort of internet terminology, who are always prepared to kind of make it difficult for anyone to talk about Palestine. And but in the case of Gaza Action Ireland, Near FM, who I know, Jack asked me along here today, Near FM had a presenter who interviewed some of my comrades from Gaza Action Ireland and discussed their recent time in Gaza and discussed the situation in Gaza, and a formal complaint was made. So on this occasion, the nature of the flak was a formal complaint to the through the broadcasting complaints procedures of the BAI. And as probably I'm sure most of you in the room are aware, the BAI made a decision that this particular broadcast violated the terms of the need for balance in broadcasting. I think it wasn't a very good decision, but I'm allowed to say that. What happened on Near FM was a presenter also decided that he would say that, and the power of flak was really, really confirmed when this excellent radio station, Near FM, actually made it its policy that if you want to talk about Israel-Palestine in any way, on any program, across this radio station, you need to come to management first and clear the specific details of that item. Boy, that's a really good disincentive to do an item about Israel and Palestine. And that is, it seems to me, a really cautionary tale that because of a formal complaint that was taken, a station which is clearly trying to do good work in this and many other areas felt compelled to make a decision that constrained the editorial freedom of its staff to that extent that you have to essentially make a written submission to management in order to do an item on a program on this topic. And that's why it seems to me that we have to watch out when we think about the idea of balance. We have to think about it in terms of structures of power and the capacity of powerful organizations and individuals to make balance an instrument of censorship, an instrument of, at the very least, of an encouragement to avoid stories. If we're going to play the balance game, we need to see that balance done in a genuine way and not always be something that is kind of subject to the pressure of an organization like Shell or an institution like the Israeli government. So yeah, that's perfect. So I'll leave it there, and I look forward to hearing what you guys have to say about it. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, another name in investigative journalism who can kind of move on this story about Shell. Frank Connolly, someone called him moral watchdog in a country, head of communications for a country's biggest trade union. Well,
thanks, Serena.
Take care.
Okay. Hi, and thanks for inviting me. I'm going to take a different tack than Harry, who has rightly pointed out some very important constraints, I suppose, on journalism, and not to mind all of the other constraints that are out there in terms of the way the media has changed over the years, and we can perhaps discuss that later. But I'm going to talk about something, and I was thinking the other day about what I was going to say to this question of whether the media influences political choices. And the obvious answer, of course, is yes. That was pretty simple. And then I realized, actually, I have a book coming out next week. And I thought, what an opportunity to promote a book which has not been published. That's the first copy of it. And I thought that it fits in very nicely because there's one chapter in the book that deals precisely with this issue. The book is about corruption and about how a guy called Tom Gilmartin came to Ireland back in the 80s to try and develop two business projects and ended up, every time he turned around, being screwed by various politicians for money. And because he refused to bow to the prevailing culture of in Irish planning at the time, ended up being effectively destroyed financially and personally, and died prematurely last year. And very sadly, in November, in my view, to a great deal of his demise was caused by his experience in Ireland in trying to create employment and jobs in a very depressed economy. So, if you remember, and I'll have to keep this short because I've only got 10 minutes left. In September 2006. There was an emotional interview by Brian Dobson on RTE with the then Taoiseach Bertie Ahern. And it went on a long time, that interview, and during the course of which the Taoiseach explained about monies he'd received into his accounts back in the years 1992 to 95 when he was the Minister for Finance. Well, up to late 94 he was Minister for Finance, before the government collapsed. And he was explaining how all of this arose, these monies that arrived into his various accounts because of his marriage breakdown and the trauma surrounding that. And he told the Irish public over the course of a very lengthy interview in his office in Drumcondra how he had been forced to accept monies from friends of his in the form of dig-outs. The first of which amounted to about 30,000, and you know, in December of 1993, and the second of which amounted to about the same, maybe 25-30 grand, in 1994, including another dig out in Manchester from friends, the names of whom he couldn't remember, who gave him another whack of about 10 grand, and the Irish public were pretty perplexed about this interview on television. And Bertie Ahern went on at great length as to how his marriage had effectively forced him to accept reluctantly these monies. Now, that was an astonishing piece of television. And of course, most people didn't realise what the context, what the background to this was, except for people who actually were working in the Mahan, or Flood Mahan Tribunal, as it was then known, which had been pursuing him since 2004 to explain why large amounts of monies had gone into his various bank accounts during that period from 92 to 95. In fact, they were pursuing five particular lodgements, all of which were preceded by foreign exchange transactions. They amounted to, in today's terms, not a huge amount of money. But you talked about roughly £175,000 as they were then. And they included lodgements of £20,000 in 1993, around the time that he got his first dig out, another £25,000 in 94 in March, another £20,000 in June, and then another couple in September, and one extraordinary lodgement of £22,000, roughly £772 in December the 5th of 1994, just as the government actually collapsed, the Fianna Fáil Labour government. That all of those were preceded. The tribunal knew at the time, but nobody else knew when they were listening to this interview on RTE, by large round figure sterling amounts of 20, 25, 20, etc. And in the December case of 1994, a $45,000 amount lodged in the bank to his name, to accounts under his control by his partner, by his then partner, on December the 5th, 1994. So the point of the exercise, and this comes back to the question as to whether the media influences politics, the point of the exercise, as we now know, was that 6 months later, that is in May, June 2007, and a general election was due, and Ahern knew that unless he came up with some sort of credible explanation as to these monies, which were now going to be opened up in the course of the tribunal's investigations over the coming months, that is in the autumn and winter and early 2007, he had to come up with a viable explanation, and that's where the so-called dig-out theories emerged. Okay, let's roll on then to a day in April of 2007, and I'm taking the benefit now of not reading a speech but reading a chapter of this forthcoming book. On Sunday, the 29th of April 2007, the country awoke to the unexpected news that a general election had been called. While Bertie Ahern's second five-year term as Taoiseach was coming to an end, the manner in which the election was called for 24th of May, less than a month later, was as peculiar as it was unprecedented. A selected number of journalists from the main news media were called by the Taoiseach's press office and brought up to Áras an Uachtaráin. And in the early hours of the morning, Ahern arrived, went in to meet President McAleese, and asked her to dissolve the Dáil. He said afterwards that the reason he did this was because McAleese was about to go on a trip to the United States, and that he wanted her to be in the country when the Dáil was dissolved. She in turn replied that she actually had told the government several weeks before that she was going to the United States, and there was nothing new about that. So a lot of questions were asked as to the timing and choice of this particular date for the election. Meanwhile, in the days before the 29th of April, I had contacted the Taoiseach's office with a series of questions based on information that I had received about his private explanations to the Mahan Tribunal about the monies that I referred to earlier, the so-called dig-out monies. And had written a lengthy story based on the full transcripts of his private interviews and those of others, including the famous bagman Michael Wall, who came, if you remember, from Manchester with a bag full of sterling, he said, 30 grand in cash. pulls up at the Ashling Hotel on the Keys, probably the safest and most secure hotel in Ireland, throws his bag of money into the wardrobe, he said, and left it overnight while he went off to a function in Clontarf for Bertie's annual fundraising, and took a couple of grand out of the bag, left the bag in the wardrobe, as he said, and spent a couple of grand. He said he spent some money at the event, but the next day he comes up, plonks the money with sterling on the table in St. Luke's in Drumcondra for Bertie Hearn. He said it was about 30,000 sterling, but maybe a mixture of Irish pounds, because he'd spent some money the night before. This was the 30 grand that was the explanation for what we later learned was a $45,000 lodgement. I won't go into the detail as to where the $45,000 may have come from. That's all in the book, actually. but I will tell you what actually we reported and what emerged from that, because this was the second general election that Ahern had faced, and he was on the rocks. There was no question about it. He was seriously in trouble because of his financial affairs, and yet, as we all know, he survived that election and emerged into a third term, third term as Taoiseach. Sorry, and we all know what happened after that. So, on Sunday, the same day that he went to the park, and on the same day that the Sunday Independent were able to report exclusively that the election was going to be held the following month. And the date of that election. We went through quite a detailed story in the Mail on Sunday, for whom I worked at the time, and led with a story which said Taoiseach Bertie Ahern has made a series of extraordinary admissions to the Mahon Tribunal that could prove fatally damaging. We wish. The Irish Mail on Sunday can reveal that Ahern gave a private interview to the Tribunal earlier this month. He was questioned about payments he received in Dublin and Manchester in 93 and 94 and about the purchase of his house from businessman Michael Wall. Mr. Ahern, who may call an election as early as today for May 24th, that was lifted straight from the Sunday Independent, I would suspect, told Tribunal lawyers he received a briefcase containing 30 grand in cash from Mr. Wall in December 94, which was to be spent doing up the house. He himself immediately put a further 50 grand in cash towards refurbishing the house, even though at the time Mr. Wall was still the owner. His then girlfriend, Celia Larkin, opened two bank accounts in her own name to lodge the money, but on behalf of Mr. Ahern and Mr. Wall. Try and keep track of this now. At the time, he was desperate to acquire a permanent address because he thought he was about to become Taoiseach when Albert Reynolds was forced to fall on his sword in November 1994. On several occasions in the mid-90s, he bought large sums in sterling, some of it in order to repay Mr. Wall, he said, but he never did. He was amazed to discover that in 1996, while he was still Mr. Wall's tenant, the businessman made a will leaving the house to Mr. Ahern. He then, the article went on and explained that some of the people that he claimed had been participating in these digouts actually said they weren't friends of his at all, including the current head of the Irish Stock Exchange, Padraig O'Connor, said that actually he'd given a donation to Fianna Fáil and didn't realise that it ended up in Ahern's personal accounts. The point is that during that whole period, despite the clear unease and unrest about Ahern's personal finances, that the manner in which the media reported this story meant that the election campaign could have gone either way. It really was determined by the way in which the media reacted to quite a fundamental story about the most powerful man in the country and his personal finances at a time when he was Minister for Finance in the mid-90s. But extraordinarily, the largest newspaper at the time, instead of reporting the story, and they had exactly the same details as I had and as the Mail had, decided not to report on it. They gave various explanations for that, in fact, latterly, the most recent explanation in about 2008, 2009, came from the current editor of the Sunday Independent, who said that the reason they didn't report on Ahern's finances, even though they had the details, was because the newspaper had a promise, the former editor had a promise from Ahern that he would give them all the details about the forthcoming election and when it was going to take place, etc., etc. During that election campaign, the same newspaper, which is the most powerful newspaper group in the country, unashamedly supported Ahern and ignored all of these issues that were central to the campaign. In fact, Vincent, who's about to speak next, did raise this issue in an Irish Times column a couple of weeks later when he highlighted the confusion that struck the Progressive Democrats at the time, which of course went into government with Fianna Fáil on the platform that it would save the country from corruption, if you remember all of that, climbing lampposts, etc., etc., and how their then leader, the leader of the Progressive Democrats, agonised over how he would react to the details and emerging revelations about Ahern's finances, but only did so reluctantly, and had got private details from the Sunday Independent at the time about what was going on. However, the point is, the newspaper and the issue of Ahern's finances, which was patently a huge issue during the 2007 election campaign, didn't have the impact perhaps it should have had because of the manner in which it was handled by the people around Ahern, and more importantly by the media generally, and particularly by independent news media. And as a result, of course, we got Bertie Ahern for a third term, and 2 years later, we know what happened. The economy collapsed.
Thanks very much.
Thanks to Frank Connolly, he did really answer our question. I would just like to ask our final speaker here today to answer our question. Do the media influence our political views? Man's of many questions, and I hope many answers. Vincent Brown.
I can have a very short speech, make a very short speech, and the answer is yes. Before you tap the bell there, how long have I got?
15.
How many?
15.
Do I have to speak for that long?
No. If you're at 14, I'll give you one.
All right. Isn't this a magnificent room? Just look at it. Isn't it fantastic? Imagine the Moon Tory having all the money to have a lovely room like this, and that room too. Isn't it just magnificent? And of course, this was just one of several magnificent rooms and houses that were around this area, built in the late 18th century. And also in Fitzwilliam Square and Marion Square, was it really magnificent, really beautiful places. But just think of the life within these houses, the lives of the people who owned the houses, and the families of the people that owned the houses. They must have been warmed by all these fires that were in these rooms. For it would have been difficult to have kept these rooms warm in winter, and the fires no doubt dealt with that problem. And it must also have been difficult to get up and down the stairs. Must have been a terrible problem, particularly if this was the dining room, probably was the dining room, and having to go down all the stairs and bring up all the food up here. How would that have been done? And of course it was done by servants. And the servants probably would have lived on the very top floor, if not in the basement, certainly not in any of the magnificent floors in between. And think of the lives of the servants during those days, and think of what they thought of themselves. They would have thought it was absolutely correct, absolutely normal course of human life, that there would be masters and servants. For that was the ideology of the time, that was the mindset of the time, that this was ordinary, this was fair enough, this was okay. It was incidentally okay that so strong were mindsets, other mindsets, for instance, slaves in America, that when slaves started to run away, other slaves, obedient slaves, would have chased them on behalf of the masters to bring them back because they believed slavery was okay. Indeed, loads of people for years and years, for millennia, thought slavery was okay. Almost certainly Jesus thought slavery was okay. Certainly Paul thought slavery was okay. The people who signed the American Declaration of Independence thought slavery was okay. Not because they were hypocrites, really. Not because they were bad people, but because that was the mindset of the day, that was how it was. And that's why in the 18th and 19th centuries, people living in these houses, both the servants and the aristocracy who lived here, believed that this was okay, this was the normal course of, this was how it was in society. There were rich people, there were poor people, there were powerful people, there were people with no power at all, there were people... there were people who mattered and people who didn't matter. But things, of course, change completely now. And in independent Ireland, we're all the same. We all matter. You don't see houses like this. You don't have servants tripping up and downstairs. You don't have rooms heated by coal. None of that anymore. But we still have a situation where some people matter and other people don't matter. Where some people have power and other people have no power at all. Where few people rather have power and other people have no power at all. Where there are huge disparities of wealth. Some people have massive wealth and other people have hardly any wealth. But also a large section of society are very comfortable, thank you, now that you mention it. And a lot of people are very uncomfortable, thank you, now that you mention it. But that's for at the heart of our society is a deep inequality. And what is interesting about it is that we too in our society think that's okay. That's the way it is. You can't disturb it. As people thought in the 19th century that the houses like this were okay. That the people, just think of the labour that went on and the skill that went into these walls, this magnificent plasterwork. Just think of this. And they thought this was okay to give their skills and their labour for the enjoyment of the aristocracy at the time, of the elite at the time. And similarly, we do exactly the same nowadays. It's not maybe as glaring as it was then, but it's essentially the same. And how is it that that people over all these all the millennia and today, that we all think it's okay what is manifestly unjust? How is it? And it's because of ideology. It's because of mindsets. That's why people thought slavery was okay, because the mindset of that era thought slavery was okay. It's the natural order of things. It's okay. We often hear of the great democracy that was in Athens at the time, and this was a golden era of equality. No, it wasn't. The people who had votes in Athens were men, women didn't have votes, and slaves didn't have votes. And nobody thought that there was anything odd about that. Just on the issue of women, for years and years and years, we thought it was okay for women to be excluded from the workforce in many instances. My mother did a degree in science. She was quite an unscientific person. Did a degree in science and bachelor's and master's degree in science at UCC in the 1920s. Went to teach in Monaghan, St. Louis Convent in Monaghan. The moment she got married, gone. Couldn't work and couldn't teach anymore. People excluded from the public service all throughout Ireland. Women excluded from the public service throughout Ireland. And everybody thought that was okay. People never thought that, for instance, that men and women were equal. That would be silly. It was manifestly ordained by God the Creator that men and women were not equal. That, for after all, when you think about it, women were an afterthought. But it's not good for man to be alone, the Lord said. And he said, extracted a rib from Adam's side and, hey, presto, there's a woman to keep him company. Not to share life or anything, but it's not good for man to be alone after. And anyway, probably would have had no sex anyway unless there was a woman. Certainly no sex. Well, anyway, let's not get into it. Anyway, the point I'm making is that we are ruled essentially by ideology. And people say, oh, son, I'm not ideological. It's all Mary Harney. I'm above ideology. I'm not right. This is all for the boards. This is all 19th century, 20th. It's all Marxist bullshit and all that. But how is it? How do you otherwise explain that noble, rational, moral people thought that what we now regard as gross injustice, how did they think gross injustice was okay? And how nowadays, in 100, 200, 300, 5,000 years' time, people, if they know anything about this era, will look back and say, how the Jesus did they think that this disparity of wealth and power and influence and lifestyle and longevity and all of that thing, how do they think that was okay? And the reason for it is that we are all, that our society and our beings are dominated by ideology. That's the way it is. And how does ideology come about? How are we framed by ideology? And I suggest to you, we're framed by ideology by three factors. One is religion. And religion, by the way, wasn't religion a fantastic idea? How else? Many of you, I'm sure, have not had the excruciation of reading all of the Bible, and particularly the Old Testament. But if you do, one thing that leaps out from the Old Testament is this is a handbook of control, particularly of control of women. And I suspect that the control of women started when private property came around, when private property emerged, fellas wanted to be sure that that kid is my kid, not that fellow's kid. And therefore, women had to be controlled because men wanted to be sure that private property was going to be going to their children, not somebody else's children. And therefore, the control of women became an essential. And I'm not sure there wasn't some element of control of women prior to that, but some element of control of women was necessary at that time. And to that aid came religion. Isn't fantastic? The Old Testament came and such a fantastic handbook of controlling of women. And that's just an illustration of how religion is very much part of the framing of ideology. But secondly, education is a huge factor. And I don't mean just formal education in primary schools or secondary schools or universities or whatever, though that's certainly a factor. I'm talking about the enculturation of people as they grow up. That women are taught to be pretty little beings and have pink dresses and lovely bows in their hairs and all that from the age that they're 4.5 months. And afterwards we wonder, sure it's true that they want dolls and fellas don't, so it's obvious there's a big difference between men and women. Of course there's a big difference in the mindset of girls and boys, because almost from the word go they're enculturated with this idea that they're, you know, the genderification of, I never heard that word and made it up before and I have to work at it of life. So I'm saying religion is a huge factor in creating ideology. Education is a huge factor, but the third factor is the media. Now, the media frames the way we think about the big issues. For instance, even left-wing people, I'm sure Harry and Frank and all that, and many of you here, will think the big issue is this austerity thing. If we could only persuade them to get rid of austerity, this thing of austerity, it's made all this, it's the bloody European Angela Merkel and this bloody austerity the problem. No, it isn't the problem. Austerity isn't the problem at all. We don't have any problem in this society. There's no difficulty about writing the fiscal balance. There's no difficulty in getting out of wealth. It'll take a while, all right, getting out of wealth. The problem is inequality. That if we were all paid the same, for instance, we wouldn't be whinging about austerity. We wouldn't be going on about it. It would, you know, it'd be uncomfortable. It would be awkward and all that. It would, but that's all. The problem is inequality. And the insidiousness of equality is not just, and people say, oh, this is fucking begrudging stuff, and you don't have enough money, and you're just begrudging people who made a success in their lives. Bullshit. The problem about inequality is, this insidiousness of inequality is the way it belittles people. That's essentially what it's about. That so many people feel, I'm a nobody. I have no voice. Nobody will listen to me. And not do they alone, do they say it, they feel it. Because our system, the massive inequality we have in our society, belittles people. It also, of course, causes 5,000 people a year to die in prematurely. Nobody pays a blind bit of attention to this at all. But as found by the report Inequalities in Mortalities, Inequality in Mortalities that was published, I think it was the year 2000. But nobody paid a blind bit of attention to it, even though it was paid for by the state. And all the other things, like the powers, like I was listening to the business on RT Radio as I was coming feverishly in, speak here in time, like then, made a mess. But anyway, I was listening to Catherine Day, the Secretary General of the European Commission, being interviewed by George Lee. And they're going on about problems that George Lee said, well, isn't it terrible that some people, some people are hurt by all of the, and she was saying, oh, yes, it is, but the fiscal problems have got to be dealt with and stuff. And we have in the European Union, we have programs to deal with exclusion, you know, and we have programs to deal with poverty, and there are 20 million people in poverty, and the objective of the European Union, and we're a bit behind the objective, is we're going to deal with it. So you frame, you soften the anxiety that there is among so many people about the injustice of inequality. You soften it by these blandishments about, oh, we'll deal with the poor and all that stuff, we'll deal with this. But the essential problem is inequality, and it's it's inequality of income, but it's also inequality of power. It's inequality of influence, and it's inequality of education and health, and all of the rest, and in longevity. That's the insidious thing, and this is allowed to persist because our mindsets have been led to perceive that this is okay. And the media has had a major role in conveying how justifiable it is. It is true that some of the corruption, as we call it, of individual politicians, and Frank did great work in exposing this, and we got Bertie Harnett and elsewhere. It's an issue, but I think actually it's a distraction, because what the problem in our society is indeed corruption, but it is not corruption of individual office holders. It's the corruption of the society itself, and the corruption that is inherent in inequality, and the viciousness and cruelty of inequality. That's it is. And the media has had a huge role, one of the huge determinant roles, along with religion and along with education, in making us feel that's okay. So answer to the question, does the media influence our political views? Yes.
Thanks to our speakers, and I'm glad they all have kind of different angle there to answer our questions. And in one way, how media mediate, and we start as a Creole, we try this conference to be more interesting and to bring more people. So we mediate in one way to put this question in that way: do the media influence our political views ahead of local and European elections? And I know you're eager now to ask a few questions, our guests. So we'll just one question will be answered, and you can insist who you would like to be answered. So if not.